Good day, podcast listeners. This week it's about presidential decorum, which in fact is pell-mell, madam.
You know, David, let me ask you this question.
Yes, sir.
In the essay that I wrote this week and in much of our discussion, the question is, has there ever been a president of the United States who exhibited less presidential decorum than President Trump? And it's not a rhetorical question. What do you think?
From my limited knowledge, the answer is negative.
That's mine, too.
I would almost want to talk to a presidential historian, although you're pretty good on that.
Well, you know, I've done my homework on this, and so I think, well, who are they? So Theodore Roosevelt could be rude, not this way, but, you know, he was a name caller and a bully, and he once had a meeting with, there was an anthracite coal strike, and he called in the coal operators, and one of the coal operators, George Bear, of Pennsylvania, was so arrogant and so dismissive of labor and so unyielding in this meeting that Roosevelt had called, that Roosevelt said, I wanted to just chuck him out the window. and I wish kind of that he had. But so, you know, so Andrew Jackson is maybe the best analogy. Andrew Jackson was a bully and he was a dualist and he was kind of a populist with a capital P and a hard and angry man and a very assertive one. And when he has the most famous inauguration in American history because people came in and trashed the White House. I don't think that could have happened with Donald Trump. But he's probably the analogy. Donald Trump and Andrew Jackson, and Trump himself has likened himself to Andrew Jackson, not with a great deal of historical discernment, but nevertheless, he has done that. But that's about it. I mean, if you think of gauche behavior in presidents, well, there's Bill Clinton, of course. That's a certain type of gauche behavior. And we have Nixon, I mean, swearing in unbelievable ways in the White House tapes and anti-Semitic comments. And
you know, that stuff doesn't bother me so much as the things that cause loss of life and incredible injustice.
Well, of course.
This week, I finally sort of formally thanked President Jefferson.
You did, actually.
For, you know, and I should do that more often because it's so great that he will come and share his perspective with us. And this perspective that it really, you wanted this conversation, and then I did a bunch of looking into things, and looking at presidential decorum, how a president handles himself publicly and as an administrator and with other dignitaries. So, you know, I don't want to be an apologist for our current president at all, but we did come to this idea about diplomatic reset, and certainly that's what Jefferson did. I don't know if that's what's happening now or not. I suppose you could be optimistic and say that's what's happening.
I don't know. I can't explain the reset. You know,
it doesn't make sense.
You want to find the underlying logic of it, and I don't see it. So look at it this way. If remember during the campaign when Donald Trump mocked the disabled reporter?
Right.
Okay, so if the next day his poll numbers had dropped by 20 points, he would have stopped doing that. In other words, it's a response system. So if I say we're going to build a wall and we're going to make the Mexicans pay for it, if the American people think, you know, we're not going to do that and they're not going to pay for it and we're not going to buy that kind of rhetoric, then your poll numbers drop and then you have to adjust. But he kept getting fed by it.
Get into that in the Jefferson Watch or the essay.
But
the
don't
end
you
of the
think
show.
So that he's been rewarded for this by his base? That's what's so interesting is that something that may just completely appall you is that he's reinforced by his base, and so he's not playing it to you. He's playing it to people who say, "That a boy, do that, stick it to him." This is finally we have someone who tells it like it is, and someone who stands
right
up to those people. So the response he's getting, it's marginalizing him because if you're at 35% and then you alienate virtually everybody else, you're eventually at 35%. He only won the election by crossing over to some 40-some percent. And so we'll see. But my point is that we're living through, I think, one of the strangest moments in American history, David.
during my lifetime, for sure.
Because we have this guy who is really like your crazy uncle, and yet he does it, and he doesn't seem to think that it's hurting him. And in some sense, it's not, because his base can't get enough of it. They bring it on, honey.
Look at Jefferson and this sort of the incident with Mary and the reset. And
I love that.
But he had, you know, by the end of his term, he had incredible public opinion behind him.
But remember, too, that when this was one incident in 8 years.
Right.
People came away from dinners at Jefferson's White House and said, oh, I've never had a better meal.
Yeah, we didn't talk enough about that.
The wines were in this episode. There were seven different wines that Mr. Jefferson made me feel like the most important person in the room. He's interested in every subject that I was interested in. He asked me about my constituents back home or the flax farming that I'm doing in Maryland.
We should devote a show to his dinners.
I mean, Jefferson was he was absolutely the most gracious host you could possibly imagine. And so when he decides on occasion to engage in political theater, as with Anthony and Mrs. Mary, the ambassador, and the ambassador's wife from Britain, he's doing it in a pointed way to say something about the nature of America. But there was also, and I think I admitted this in the last portion of the program, there was a bit of a long memory that Jefferson had from 1786 when George III turned his back on him at a levee in London. And Jefferson thought, hey, can't bygones be bygones just because I wrote a document, you know?
All I know is what goes around comes around, and it did in Jefferson's case, and it may in our time as well.
I love this side of Jefferson,
me
the
too.
Whimsical Jefferson, because normally if he came today to everyone who's listening's house, people would probably think, are you real? Because you're so gracious and mannered and your etiquette is exquisite, and you never say anything.
I don't know. It might be the perfect time for him to come
back.
Maybe
this is his moment. But generally speaking, today we live in a world that's much more casual.
But let's go back to Jefferson's world and listen to the show this week.
This is one of the fun ones.
It's called Presidential Decorum. We hope you enjoy it.
Thanks for listening, folks.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay Jenkinson. I'm your host, David Swenson. And seated across from me now is President Thomas Jefferson. Good to see you, sir.
Good day to you, my dear citizen.
I trust all is well with you. Your gardens are growing and your horses are doing well and you're enjoying your time.
Nature is fertile. Nature supplies human needs. To the extent that we cooperate with nature and nature's God, we are happy and virtuous and independent. To the extent that we become dependent on institutions or individuals or urban densities, we lose our natural independence and our freedoms. And so Monticello, in addition to being a working farm and a laboratory of different types of gardens, a continuing building project in architecture for me, but in addition to all of that, Monticello is a grounding for me in nature with a capital N. And when you do that, when you put your hands in the soil, you invariably have an encounter with nature's God. It's not the God of the Old or New Testament. It's not some hoary white figure with a beard and white robes. It's more Newtonian. It's gravitation. It's centrifugal and centripetal force. It's the seasons. It's the Earth's axis and in precisely the place that it is. Who knows what caused it? But if it weren't for that tilt of 23 or so degrees, there would be no seasons and there probably could not be life of the kind that we enjoy on Earth. And so when you see this, when you see the regularity of planetary motion and the extraordinary way in which winter yields to spring, spring to summer, summer to the harvest, and winter again. When you see rainfall in clouds, and it fills our creeks and rivers, they run to the sea, and yet there's evaporation, and it's all renewed countless times. When you see the rhythms and the orderliness of the natural world, of what the Greeks called the cosmos. Cosmos in Greek means orderly. Then you become aware that there's a benevolent creator, that humans can understand the world, that we can work with vines to prune them, and we can work with garden plants to weed them and to thin them. When humans cooperate with nature, happiness ensues. And when humans turn away from nature and think that they're somehow smarter than nature, that's when things go badly.
Well stated, Mr. President. You know, in spite of the fact that you and I are separated by decades of, well, centuries of time, I could not agree with you more, sir.
But Isaac Newton's law of gravitation, I believe, still operates in your time.
Yes, it does, sir.
But the Old Testament may no longer seem valid.
Well, that might be a long conversation.
But you see my point, that the laws of nature are permanent and invariable and discoverable. Gold is never helium, and helium is never iron, and iron is never hydrogen. These things are distinct. A cottonwood is not a cypress, and an elephant is not a mammoth. As long as we understand these things and classify them thoughtfully, we discover invariable underlying laws of nature, and they don't change.
These absolute truths should be a steadying influence for all of us as human beings, don't you think, sir?
Yes, that's the point, that Newton's great discovery of the basic thermodynamics of nature, and particularly his universal law of gravitation, gave the Enlightenment, gave my era, extraordinary confidence. Because if everything is governed by that, you know, Venus, Saturn, Mars, a disc being dropped from the Leaning Tower of Pisa, a coin being dropped on the ground from your pocket, if everything is governed by that simple law, then there probably are ways to see other laws, laws of chemistry, laws of motion, laws of the way the human brain works, laws of the circulation of the heart or the nature of growth. And what Newton showed us was that the seeming chaos of the world is not chaos at all. We just haven't looked at it through the right and rational lens. And that gave us all a sense that the world was knowable, that when we knew things, we would make our institutions better because they would resonate with nature and nature's God. It empowered us to believe that equality is the self-evident essence of life. In other words, let's say you're born in Siberia in some sort of a wigwam, and I'm born in Paris. I am surrounded by French society. You are surrounded by this wilderness. But we are equal in our humanity. We are each born with a blank slate. And if we switch places, if as an infant, if I were taken to Siberia, and as an infant, if you were brought to Paris, you would grow up French and I would grow up Siberian, that we don't bring anything with us when we're born. We are the sum total of the stimuli, the things that are inscribed on the tabula rasa of our heart and our brain. And that gives everybody a sense of the possibilities. You may be born a Negro slave at Monticello or Montpelier or Mount Vernon, but you are a human being, and with the right social circumstances and the right legal structure, you probably can thrive at the same level as any other person on earth. And that gave us a sense that our rebellion was not some sort of a selfish anti-tax protest movement of a colonial system. Our rebellion was because we understood certain self-evident and unalienable laws of social structure and human right, and we insisted upon any government respecting those. If it hadn't been for Newton, there probably would not have been John Locke's Second Treatise on Government, and there probably would not have been an American Revolution, at least in the way that we expressed it.
Mr. Jefferson, I'm not sure that, I thank you enough for being willing to look forward to my time so I can look backward towards yours and in this process better understand the times that I live in now, sir.
Well, thank you, sir. And, you know, for me, this is why I live in nature. I'm not happy in cities. I regard them as artificial. They create densities that produce urban riots and social unrest and inequalities of distribution of the goods and fruits of life. They become centers of disease. You know, a disease has a very hard time in a diffused population. But if you pack 100 people into a city block, then if somebody gets the smallpox, that's going to travel very, very quickly. And so almost everything becomes more problematic in urban situations which are distanced or alienated from the earth, from the soil. And almost everything becomes simpler, more understandable, more healthful, and indeed more independent and virtuous when you are on the land. So it wasn't, I could have lived anywhere. I could have stayed in Paris. I could have lived in Philadelphia. I could have moved to New York. But I felt that Monticello was a place where I could be a full human being and I could think straight and I could pursue the Virgilian dream of a nation of farmer citizens.
And yet you did spend a great deal of time away from Monticello. And I'd like to talk to you, sir, about the time you spent in Washington, D.C. as our third president, if that would be all right. There are some things that I would like you to help me to understand, sir, and that is how you viewed the presidency in the terms of, say, procedures, decorum, how you dealt with foreign nations. Would that be a suitable subject for conversation, sir?
Of course. Let me just begin by saying that I did not seek the presidency. In a sense, the presidency sought me. But I brought to the presidency what I would have brought to anything that I did in my life, which is a high level of respect for others, a refusal to believe that I'm the only voice in the room, an understanding that diversity is the nature of things, and therefore no individual ever has a corner on virtue or truth. And in fact, it's when we share our opinions and our principles and our concerns by way of majority rule that we sort these things out and do the best for the largest number of people in our society. So as president, I never thought of myself as the king of America or the prime minister or the most important American or the leader of the free world or anything else like that. I thought of myself as a citizen like many other citizens, fortunate in that I had been very well educated thanks to the circumstances of my birth, and that preparation had made me no better than anybody else, but perhaps better informed about certain public questions than others. But I was drawn into public life, and I would really rather have stayed in private life at my beloved Monticello. But when your nation calls, especially at a time of revolution, your duty is to avoid ambition, to look carefully into your own heart to see that it's pure. But if the people need you for some public service, whether it's leading the armies against Great Britain or whether it is writing a state document like the Declaration of Independence or, for that matter, serving as the President of the United States, you take a deep breath and sigh and put your plow in the shed and get on your horse and go to the place that is expected of you and do the best job you can as humbly and as simply and as transparently as possible. And then as soon as it seems decent, you return to private life where your true happiness resides.
I wonder, sir, if sometimes the American public doesn't rely on their leaders a bit too much.
I think you do, because in a republic like ours, everyone should be equal. We govern ourselves, and so ideally we need no formal government at all. We do, because our numbers are too many for that, and our habits are decidedly derived from European experience, and so we're not really ready for the kind of democratic anarchy that would be ideal. But in a republic, you want the least political and social hierarchy that you can possibly accept, and you want the maximum of human equality and self-reliance, self-government that's practicable within the limits of good sense and an eye to historical chances.
Thank you, Mr. President. We need to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. And this week, Mr. Jefferson, you've been good enough to agree to talk a bit about your policies, your ideas of decorum. And I so appreciate that, Mr. President.
Well, I tried always to be generous. Even when I dislike somebody or dislike their principles, I tried to find some level of agreement. I tried not to ruffle their feathers. You know, my whole bent was harmony and to try to move towards conciliation and common ground rather than to sharpen the edges. And I wasn't a name caller. I despaired of certain people. I said once in a letter to James Madison that we must devoutly pray for the early death of Patrick Henry. And I should apologize for that. That was, I don't even believe in the efficacy of prayer, certainly not prayer of that sort. And it was uncharacteristic of me to lash out in a private letter that way.
Well, I'm a bit confused, Mr. President, because on the one hand, here you are, the gentleman who wrote the manual of parliamentary practice for the Senate, which is something that's still in use today. And on the other hand, when it came to how you handled the White House, guests at the White House, you were completely unconventional. Looking from the outside in, it's almost as if there were two different gentlemen running these things.
I see it a little bit differently. It's true that I broke with the habits of my predecessors, and I broke with some European habits of hospitality. But let me explain why. First of all, we are an experimental republic, a kind of proto-democracy. And I did not want to create social hierarchies and social ceremonials in our republic of the sort that we routinely see and even accept in Europe. That's, for example, not to digress, but why I didn't have a grand staircase at Monticello, because in Europe, grand staircases are used to express hierarchy. The lord of the manor comes down the stairs and condescends to greet people at lower and lower social stations.
You never did that, did you,
sir? No, I didn't. I wanted to put an end to that kind of ceremonial and that kind of social hierarchy. I'm an equalitarian. Certainly, I believe in merit, that those who are the most excellent at things should rise to positions of leadership. But anyone can show merit, whether you're born in a hovel or a palace or, for that matter, a monastery. So I believed in that very strongly. And so I wanted to break. And in my two predecessors, John Adams and George Washington, were great men, please don't get me wrong, but they were sufficiently backward-looking to Europe that they took their presidential style as a kind of watered-down version of the British court. George Washington held levees. That's what kings do. George Washington would not shake hands with the people. He bowed stiffly to them because that's what kings do. He went on a progress, first to New England one year and then to the southern states another year to kind of show himself off, to show himself to the American people. That's what kings do. This is called a progress in British history. It's not that he was a bad man. He certainly didn't have monarchical tendencies, but he wasn't sure how a president should behave. And he believed, and he was pressed by others to do this, that the president needed somehow to elevate himself and to create some formal detachment from his subjects. I disagree with that. Washington did it with dignity, although stiffly. Adams was more of a comic figure in this regard.
Well, Mr. President, isn't that a bit harsh?
No, it's not, because Adams, for example, who never fought in any war, wore a ceremonial sword, you know, which is in itself absurd. Why would John Adams, the president of the United States, wear a ceremonial sword? And he used to get it stuck between his legs and he would trip on it, and it was very awkward.
Let's leave poor Mr. Adams.
But you
to
take
that.
My point that he yeah, that both of them were trying to figure out what a president does, how a president behaves, how a president comports himself. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be more small-d democratic, so that I could remind people that you're really governing yourself, and I'm just your first magistrate for a very short period of time.
Well, I think the American public to this day has a bit of trouble when a new president comes into office and is so vastly different than his predecessor. Now, you, sir, on the one hand, it is said that you dressed almost like a peasant when you would meet dignitaries.
That's not true, of course, but by their standards, perhaps. But there's the famous meeting with Anthony Mary, the British ambassador.
This is the one I'm thinking of because it so well describes your dress, your feet stuffed into old slippers, and it was not what people expected of a world leader.
It's not what some people did, and it was done as deliberate political theater. Let me give you a better example first. When I was inaugurated on the 4th of March, 1801, I was staying in a boarding house. I walked to my inauguration. I wore plain gentleman's clothes, no sword, no insignia, no ensigns, military regalia, nothing to mark me as somehow the President of the United States. Once I had finished delivering my inaugural address and taking the oath of office, I strolled right back to the boarding house, and they tried to move so that I could have the seat at the head of the table. I refused and sat where I had always sat. Now, some of this is just who I am, that I saw my role as that of a farmer citizen who happened now to be the President of the United States for a short period of time. But I also did it as a form of symbolism. I wanted to say to the American people, just because I'm president doesn't mean you all have to move down to a lower part of the table and defer to me. Just because I'm president doesn't mean that I'm going to travel around in a carriage with six splendid white horses and liveried footmen and so on.
But you did, sir, dress all of your servants very finely, brass buttons, uniforms.
Yes, of course. I wanted orderliness, I wanted professionalism, but I wanted to play down my own status as president. So to get to Anthony Mary.
Yes, we must share that story.
This British ambassador was stationed in Washington, D.C., and we all know that the government had moved there and that it was still pretty marginal. It was a pretty raw little frontier village with not even a good hotel and very few shops and no printing house and no good wine dispensary and so on. It was no restaurants. It was a pretty rough little upstart frontier town. And he's the representative of His Majesty, George III. And so he thinks of himself without question as having been marooned in the middle of nowhere in this godforsaken wilderness amongst these barbaric people, the Americans, who have just successfully declared independence of Britain.
So, you can't blame him, sir.
So you have to look at this through his eyes, that he is a representative of the most important nation on earth, with the possible exception of France, and he is His Majesty's servant, and he is used to a certain sort of diplomatic style and protocol, and he's never been in a place like Washington, D.C., he's never been in the New World before, and so he comes, and he's unfortunately married to a very harsh, demanding, socially pretentious wife, and he comes to pay his respects to me. And I knew he was coming because Mr. Madison had already greeted him, my best friend and Secretary of State. And when Anthony Mary came, I decided to tweak him a little. I kept him waiting. When I appeared, I was wearing slippers, that's true, and my hose were sort of down around my ankles a bit, and my hair was loosely tied, and not at all tight in the kind of a queue or a wig that you would expect to see in Paris or Vienna. And he even noticed this was not part of my political theater, but he even noticed that there was a little piece of scrambled egg on my jacket. And when he saw this, he said, "My linens were none too clean, and my style was very casual and non-formal," and he thought disrespectful because he expected me to be dressed like a European diplomat at Versailles, and instead he found this farmer citizen who I had been doing something, and I was in no hurry to jump away from whatever I had been doing to greet His Majesty's civil servant. And so this offended him. It offended him deeply, and he actually wrote a whining, self-commiserating letter to the court of St. James, complaining about the snub that he had received in the United States and from me. And, that didn't bother me particularly. I took a certain joy in it. But I can see from Anthony Mary's point of view that this was a comeuppance that he had never anticipated.
Mr. President, let's come clean here. You've used the term political theater more than once. You intended to elicit this response from Mr. Mary, did you not?
Well, yes and no. I didn't intend necessarily for him to write an angry letter to the British court. I thought that he might be a bit more genteel and...
But you were trying to set a precedent, is that correct?
I was trying to say two things. First of all, we won the Revolutionary War and successfully declared independence and defeated the greatest navy and the most powerful army on earth. And now for us in any way to kowtow to these people or to go out of our way to accommodate them or to look on them somehow as majestic or deserving of some unusual social protocol is absurd. That's number one. And number two, the kind of government we're trying to create, the social experiment that we're engaged in here, is just the opposite of all of those things, that citizens should govern themselves, but because they can't do all of it every day, they're busy, they have their lives, they're too far geographically from the centers of power, so they send representatives from amongst themselves to do some very simple public business, and they choose one of their number every fourth year to briefly serve as the presiding officer of the system, and we shouldn't think that this is king to king or dictator to dictator or aristocrat to aristocrat, that when the British come here, they should understand that this is the wave of the future, that those sorts of ridiculous medievalist ceremonials worthy of the papacy of the 9th century or the absolutism of the Stuart kings is not something that we're going to perpetuate on this side of the Atlantic Ocean. And the sooner they realize that, the better. And then Mrs. Mary made things worse, as you know, because I had to invite them to supper. That's what you do. There were no good restaurants, and I felt obligated to invite them to supper. And they came, and of course they were dressed as if the dinner were at Fontainebleau or Versailles or the Vatican. And when they arrived, it was much more casual than all of that. Not shabby, but casual. And Mrs. Mary...
American.
That's our style. And Mrs. Mary believed that as the wife of the most senior diplomat, that when dinner was announced, finally, that I would take her arm and say, "Madam, may I take you in to dinner, please?" And that Anthony Mary would be paired with Mrs. Madison or Albert Gallatin's wife, but the second most senior woman in Washington would be his escort, and that they would have pride of place, that the president would be sitting at the head of the table, and next to him would be Anthony Mary, and on the other side, Mrs. Mary, and then they would achieve their position as the most important diplomatic individuals in the world, certainly in the United States. And when the dinner was announced, there were no seating charts in my White House. I simply had round tables, and people went in and took whatever spot they chose. And I did not take Mrs. Mary's arm. I simply walked in and waited for people to sit and took my seat. And I didn't announce them in any particular way, and there were no toasts. I didn't do toasts at my White House dinners. And so they were just offended and appalled and bewildered and angry and hurt and miffed and annoyed and stuffy and horrible, and they had a terrible evening. And at the end of the evening, they were so angry by this, what they regarded as a deliberate social and diplomatic snub, that they came up to me, and they were as stiff as two broomsticks. And Mrs. Mary said in a quavering voice, "Mr. President, I demand to know what is the protocol of your administration." And I said, "Madam, it is pell-mell." And that really made things worse. And they went away, and he wrote his bitter letter to the court back in London. And then I said to Madison, "Well, we probably had better develop some sort of a formal protocol for these dinners so that people can read that in advance and know what they're getting themselves into." And I said, "If Mrs. Mary insists upon playing the virago, she must learn to sip her soup at home."
Goodness, Mr. President.
But you see this as rude. I see this as a very important moment of American democracy.
I do not see it as rude, sir. I see it as very American. When Americans see a new president come into office and his way of doing things is dramatically different, it's always a bit disconcerting to the public.
Well, what people understood, those who knew me, was that at Monticello, I would have behaved in a much more formal way, and I would have made people feel welcome, and I was a man of exquisite hospitality.
Margaret Bayard Smith has given us a lot of...
My dear friend,
yes. Given us a lot of information about these dinners that you would have. The round table was brilliant.
Because there's no head or foot. Everyone's equal. Dumbwaiter, so there are no servants coming and going.
It's fair to say, sir, that you had a real resentment for British customs.
I did resent Britain because of its hauteur, and because it tried to enslave us, and because it fought a war against us for all we were doing was declaring our rights as British citizens, and because after the war was lost, they tried to re-enslave us by way of economic policy. Yes, I have a deep, abiding skepticism and resentment, I guess is the right term, of British haughtiness and British arrogance. And since it's my country, not mine, but the country in which I happen to live, and I happen to be the president of the United States, and they happen to have turned up without my inviting them, I feel that it is it's within the realm of good sense and American principles to teach them a little lesson about all of this. And, you know, this was a gesture for the world. It was a gesture for Britain. It was a gesture for the United States. It was a gesture to the Federalists who wanted me to be much more kingly in my behavior.
I'm surprised at you a bit, Mr. President, that you would admit this out loud. For lack of a better word, we both used it, resentment of the British. There are historians in my time who say that you realize that you could use your presidency and the Constitution to pretty much write in any kind of freedom that you felt appropriate.
Well, I think that we were dealing with something unprecedented. You know, I wrote a letter at the time of my election saying it's not true that there's nothing new under the sun. You know, that's a cliche, but it's not true. Our form of government is new. The size and the magnificence and the fertility of our land is new. The manners of our people are new. The experiment that we are engaged in is new. So we're doing something unprecedented, and we have to get it right. And I felt honestly that my friends George Washington and John Adams had erred on the side of European social hierarchies, what was known as subordination, that they had taken on aristocratic manners, not because they really felt them, although sometimes Adams did, but because they didn't know what else to do, and they looked for models and found none here. And they were a little afraid to break with those habits of European pomposity because they were committed to the success of our experiment and they didn't want to be buffoons or to fail to show the proper decorum for the experiment in which we were engaged. And so they erred, I think, wrongly on the side of aristocracy and monarchy. So when I became president, being more confident in the American people and the solidity and success of our experiment, I decided to move in a different direction, and one way to do that was, I have to admit, to somewhat victimize Anthony and Mrs. Mary. But if two diplomats ever deserved to be victimized, it was they.
Mr. President, I must tell you that your guidance of, shall we call it, pell-mell, has lasted in American society to this day.
Sir, I never like to be rude, but sometimes one has to set the precedent for a society that will shock the world.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jefferson. I've enjoyed our conversation.
You are most welcome, sir.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson and your weekly conversation with the gentleman seated across from me now, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. That was a fun conversation with the president this week, sir.
Now, David, the semi-permanent guest host of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, you sounded a little bit shocked by Mr. I don't think you're really shocked by this.
No, not at all.
So, I mean, I think this is one of actually the richest, most delightful Jefferson stories we have, that this man of almost unbearable dignity and graciousness and self-control, I mean, maybe as gracious a man who as has ever been in the White House, not just presided over it, that he could be rude in this moment of political theater is great. I love this.
I really think he planned this. He wanted to shock Mary. He really didn't like the British. He was so sensitive to everything that was done and knew that, you know, every action is a reaction. I think he did this on purpose. Do you think I'm wrong?
No, of course he did it on purpose. But remember, there's a backstory here that we didn't get into, and that is that when Jefferson was in Europe, John Adams called him to London, and they were going to do some work with a Turkish or Moroccan diplomat about the Barbary pirates. And that didn't pan out, and they were trying to do a model treaty with Britain, and that didn't pan out. But Jefferson, because he had come from France, was introduced at one of the levees of George III to His Majesty George III, the King of England. And so this is the kind of thing that happens all the time. Every administration in America does it, and every court in Europe does it. You know, your credentials are presented, and you're an important official from another country, so you're presented to the leader, to the monarch. And Jefferson was dutifully trotted out by John Adams to meet George III at a levee, and George III would come in, and he would go from person to person and bow and maybe say a few words and so on. Well, when George III came up to Jefferson in his circling of the room, he turned his back on Jefferson in a rude way, as if to say, "So this is the celebrated author of the Declaration of Independence that helped to disengage my 13 colonies from the British system. I shall punish you by not giving you the attention that I would give to anybody else in this room." And Jefferson noted this and said nothing could be more mulish than the behavior of the British monarch on this occasion. And so, you know, Jefferson pocketed this memory. And so when Anthony Mary turns up at the White House, Jefferson thinks, "All right, I recall what George III did to me, and now here's this pompous fool.
A little payback.
With his wig and his diplomatic regalia and his cane and his stuffy Oxford accent and his superciliousness and his, we'd use the B word, his wife. And I'm not going to go out of my way to make him feel good. First of all, I prefer France to Britain. France is the nation that helped us win the war. Britain has done nothing good for us, and they tried to destroy us for wanting to be treated like full-grown British citizens."
You think that memory was pretty fresh in his mind?
Well, I don't think he'd ever forgotten it. I think his view was, how stuffy can you be? You know, you're now in America.
There's a new sheriff in town. Right?
You know, as my father used to tell this story, David, about when the British king came to the United States in the 1930s or something, and he was offered a hot dog. So of course, no British king wants to eat a hot dog, but he was forced to eat this hot dog, and then someone was taking pictures, and back then you had to sort of turn your head and pose. It wasn't just like snapping 50 pictures. And someone said, "Hey, look over here, Rex." And the king, you know, is just appalled that some barbarian is calling him Rex.
So Jefferson really did start a trend.
Well, we Americans, I think we've gone the wrong direction. Now, I think that we're kind of in love with ceremonial. You know, we have People magazine and Us magazine go overboard about Prince William and his children and the Middletons and Princess Diana. And
it's interesting. There's almost a desire for that among some people.
Yes, there is a desire. I mean, we love
the royals.
We wish we had royalty, and we don't. And so when you get the Kennedys, you just decide they're royal.
So it's sort of built into our American DNA, you think?
Yeah, and the Reagans, Mrs. Reagan particularly, kind of had a feeling that there was a royalty element that needed to be in American life, whereas Jimmy Carter, you know, wore blue jeans and he carried his own luggage and he stayed in, you know, Carter went overboard in the Jeffersonian direction and the American people resented it. They thought, no, you're our president. So which kind of leads us to the current occupant of the White House who, let's just put it this way, he has behaved in an unusually eccentric way if we are thinking about royalty and ceremonial and civility and protocol and a kind of the elevation that you expect from a president. His behavior has been strange in that regard, and it shows the Europeans are very edgy about his style.
No, I think it's borderline disrespectful, don't you?
It's more than borderline. I mean, I think that, I don't know what happened, David. It's the subject of today's essay, but I don't know what happened to this country that we think it's okay to shoulder the prime minister of Montenegro out of the way for a photo op, and we think it's okay for our president to go address NATO and be the first president in our history who has not affirmed Article 5. And Article 5 says the attack of one country is an attack on all of us in the alliance. Every European was needing to hear that and expecting to hear that because Trump has given such strange signals about America's alliances with NATO and with Europe. And so they needed to be reassured that whatever the campaign rhetoric was, when we get down to the real business of the future, particularly at a time of Russian expansionism, that the president of the United States would come and he would in some way, either privately or publicly, reaffirm Article 5, that the United States feels an ongoing social compact and moral responsibility to be the protector of Europe should Europe come under attack. And he didn't do it. And when you don't do those things, you're missing extremely important parts of what it is to be the representative of the most important nation on earth.
Jefferson put a thumb in the eye of Mr. Mary.
He did.
And our current president put a thumb in the eye of NATO.
Right, but here's the difference. We helped to create NATO. The NATO alliance has been one of the most important things that has ever happened in the world because if you think about the tragedies of the 20th century, World War I, World War II, the Holocaust, the pogroms in the former Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc controlled by the Soviet Union, the human rights abuses that are just through the roof and through the entire period of the Cold War, the nuclear Armageddon hanging over our head. We're not talking about one ambassador's experience in an American capital. We're talking about something of almost unbelievable importance in the world.
Well, Jefferson took a calculated risk in behavior to achieve an end, and I think he probably did it. I'm not so certain that's what's happening in our time.
Well, here's what's so paradoxical, and again, I'm not meaning to be political. I'm really trying to look at this as a phenomenological thing. But if President Trump is sticking his thumb in people's eyes or noses, it's Britain and France and Germany. And why? What does he gain by offending our staunchest allies, the nations with whom we have the deepest historic and ideological ties? It's very hard to understand what his logic can be.
I guess to me that was part of the purpose of the conversation we had with Thomas Jefferson this week. To me, what Jefferson did was a diplomatic reset in a very, well, in really in the strongest way that he could outside of taking military action or limiting trade or something like that. But in a personal sense, he did a diplomatic reset.
He did.
I am certain that there are people that were just as upset about that during his time as people are upset about Trump.
Yes. Yes, there were.
I look at that parallel.
I see the parallel. So the point is, what's the reset about? So with Jefferson, it was about a new kind of declaration of independence against Great Britain, that we're not going to kowtow to these people and not going to succumb to their social pretensions because we are our own republic now.
Well, we can't really afford that kind of independence anymore, can we?
So if that's, I mean, I think Jefferson's reset made sense. The Federalists didn't. I mean, there were people who were simply appalled by this and thought, why would you offend the most powerful trading partner that we have? We, you know, Hamilton's view is we may as well deal with them because they make money for us and we're basically the same people and we will get over this lover's spat eventually. And Hamilton proved to be right about that, by the way. So there were people who thought, what's Jefferson up to here? But the reset had a purpose. So my point is, I would like to know what the reset on NATO is because I don't get it. And I don't get why we would why he would go out of his way to offend the Germans about their car industry. It shows a almost an unbearable lack of understanding of how the 21st century car industry works in the world. But you wonder, maybe there's logic behind this. Maybe there's a point to this reset. But if so,
and maybe we're just overly optimistic.
What is the point of the reset exactly? Because if you say, you know, why don't the other nations in NATO pay their full share? Fair enough. But that can be done behind closed doors, and it has been done, by the way, by every president carefully, respectfully. Behind closed doors. But I remember 15 or 20 years ago, the United States was hundreds of millions of dollars in arrears on its UN dues. And finally, I think it was Clinton who finally said, you know, we're gonna have to catch up on – we're not paying the share that we've agreed to, whether it's fair or not. And we kind of caught up. But I'll bet we're in arrears on that again. So it's not as if – the real issue is the 2% that the NATO nations are supposed to devote to the common defense under the Atlantic Alliance. It can't be about that, paying your proper rent. So what is it about? Is it really useful? Maybe it is, but I don't think that the case has been presented to us. And I think the analogy with Jefferson's rudeness on this occasion, one of the handful of occasions in his entire long and brilliant life when he was rude, I don't think the analogy tells us very much except your term, reset. So reset is exactly right. So what's the reset that we're looking for here with Russia? What's the reset we want with China? What's the reset we want with NATO? What's the reset we want with NAFTA?
History shall tell us, sir. Meanwhile, I must thank you and President Jefferson for a fascinating conversation this week. I really enjoyed it. And with that, sir, it's time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
This week's essay, The Death of Decorum in American Life. As a scholar, not a partisan, I have been trying to think if any president in American history has behaved in a less presidential way than Donald Trump. Andrew Jackson was a frontier ruffian in some respects, a loud populist, and during his inauguration on March 4, 1829, his rural supporters from Tennessee trashed the White House. Theodore Roosevelt called his enemies colorful names. He said McKinley had the backbone of a chocolate eclair, and he called William Jennings Bryan a human trombone. His roughhousing with his rambunctious children in the White House often raised the eyebrows of the Victorian stuff shirts of his time. President Roosevelt rattled the nerves of Charles Eliot, the president of Harvard, when he showed up at his old alma mater packing a loaded pistol. When one of his pals from Dakota fretted that he might not be admitted into the White House through the usual doors, T.R. urged him the next time just to shoot out one of the White House windows. Probably he was joking. Bill Clinton famously spoke with foreign diplomats while receiving oral ministrations in the Oval Office from Monica Lewinsky and fiddling creatively with cigars. He was not the only president to have opportunistic sex in the White House, of course, but his sexual style always felt a little like it belonged in a trailer park. JFK is said to have taken LSD in the White House with one of his lovers during the workday. One hopes it was a relatively quiet day during the nuclear-tipped Cold War. Most presidents either have or adopt proper presidential deportment. Think of Ronald Reagan, a conservative populist, or George Bush Sr., a patrician, insisting on always wearing a coat and tie in the Oval Office, never propping their feet on the famous Resolute desk, and invariably speaking, at least in public, with decorum, a careful and heightened diction, and a demeanor that reflects an awareness that they are the prime representative of one of the most powerful and important nations in history, the Republic of Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, Wilson, FDR, Kennedy, Reagan, and the elegant Obama. Number 45, Donald Trump, behaves like a rich frat boy. your crazy, unfiltered uncle at the Thanksgiving table, the loudmouth at the end of the bar at 11 p.m. on a Tuesday night, the golfer who wraps his 7-iron around a tree when he misses an easy shot. Trump behaves like a psychologically damaged 70-year-old man trapped in the persona of a spoiled 13-year-old adolescent, a reality TV star who got paid millions to be brash, rude, demeaning, and narcissistic. But here's the astonishing part of it. For about 35% of the American people, it works. In fact, some significant percentage of the electorate thinks that this is precisely what America most needs. When you mock a disabled person by waving your arms in what you think is a spastic parody, declare that your wealth and celebrity allow you to grab women by their sexual parts with impunity, when you call Mexicans hombres, shove the Montenegrin prime minister out of the way during a photo op, or call terrorists who just blew up the bodies of several dozen British young people losers, a bunch of losers, okay? You would seem to prove yourself unfit for the presidency of the United States. Who really wants to defend such behavior? And yet, this man who has never tried to hide his core persona was elected president of the United States in 2016, and I have close personal friends, decent, morally mature, and sensitive men and women, who defend Donald Trump and say that he is the victim of fake news and a liberal national media that is indeed the enemy of the American people. This phenomenon is simply mystifying. Trump's behavior gets denounced every day, almost every hour of every day now. But I'm much more interested in trying to understand it, or more particularly, trying to understand why there is about a third of the population that defends such loudish and unpresidential behavior, or even fist pumps it. If your preacher talked this way, would you defend him? If a high school English teacher talked this way, would you defend it? If Barack Obama had talked this way, would you have defended that? If your best friend talked this way, would you defend it? I heard a commentator named Dylan Byers on one of the talk shows last week say that we will never recover our national social and political equilibrium until we figure out why about half the nation is so ticked off, so utterly disillusioned with America's path, so profoundly fed up, cynical, and eager to say not much more than up yours to the rest of us, that they routinely, even invariably, defend the least presidential figure in American history. I'm Clay Jenkinson. Join us again next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.